Ukraine Calling, September 9th, 2016. These were the headlines. Parliament begins a new session. Ukraine's parliament reconvened this week after its summer break. It faces a tough decision. An undeclared war continues on its territory. Domestic corruption and scandals continue to dominate the headlines. Over the next few months, elections will be held in countries that play a huge role in determining Ukraine's future: the United States, Germany, and France. Ukraine's President Poroshenko addressed the assembly. He reiterated his strategic vision of Ukraine joining NATO, but braced his country for a rocky few months ahead. He said, over the course of the next year, political forces could come to power as a result of the elections in several European countries that may not be extremist, but are inclined to compromise with the Kremlin, and which believe that the best policy against the aggressor is conciliation. He also appealed for unity, warned against internal squabbles, referring to history that in the past led to Ukraine's loss of statehood at the end of World War I. On its third day back from the holidays, Ukraine's parliament adopted a resolution calling on foreign parliaments not to recognize elections planned by the Russian State Duma in the Crimean Peninsula that Russia occupied in 2014. Later in the show, we'll bring you in-depth commentary about the challenges facing Ukraine's parliament by Deputy Speaker Oksana Siroid and Canadian parliamentarian with a long history of cooperating with Ukraine, Boris Przyznewski. In other news, the dynamic of the war seems to have changed over these past 2 weeks. Late August continued to be quite heated, with daily reports of heavy shelling and casualties, with 5 soldiers killed and 27 wounded, including one nurse. On August 27th, 12,000 residents of Luhansk were left without water because shelling destroyed their facilities. But despite fears that this would continue, on September the 1st, which is the beginning of the school year in Ukraine, the official spokesperson reported that things were quiet on almost all fronts in the Donbas. And in the first week of September, 2 soldiers were killed, 6 wounded, 1 civilian woman, and 1 policeman. Ukraine was not high up on the G20 summit agenda in China this past week. Unlike the summit in Australia, where then-Canadian Prime Minister Stephen Harper stole the headlines by refusing to shake Mr. Putin's hand for annexing Crimea. But as Newsweek reported, the Russian president was forced to backtrack on his earlier statement that he was going to pull out of the senseless negotiations with Ukraine and agreed to continue the 4-way talks brokered by Germany and France. There was mixed news on Ukraine's efforts at battling corruption and efforts at improving transparency. Ukraine Calling listeners may remember that the new system requiring government officials to declare their incomes online ran into a snag over the summer and was postponed until September the 1st. Some media outlets reported that the second attempt at the e-filing system was once again flawed. Others, including the usually critical investigative news website censor.net, were more optimistic. It reported that within a week, 816 users had registered and 118 declarations had been submitted. Former investigative journalist Serhiy Leshchenko, who went into politics in 2014, found himself under the transparency microscope this week. Reports began circulating that he and his girlfriend recently bought a luxury apartment in central Kyiv for 7.5 million Ukrainian hryvnias. Another media outlet published documents where the two of them declared incomes totaling just over 2 million in the past 7 years. Crimean Tatar leader Ilmi Umerov was released from Simferopol's psychiatric hospital on September 7th after 3 weeks of forcible confinement. Ukraine Calling listeners will remember that we reported on this in the last episode and that the deputy chairman of the Mejlis had been transferred from a regular hospital to forcible psychiatric assessment reminiscent of the old Soviet system. Upon release, he began giving interviews reporting that despite everything, he remains in good health. With me today in studio are Mr. Boris Przyznewski, member of the Canadian Parliament, the so-called House of Commons, who was recently re-elected in 2015 in a landslide victory for the Liberal Party under the new leadership of Prime Minister Justin Trudeau. Also we have with us Ms. Oksana Siroid, the Deputy Speaker of the Ukrainian Parliament and the first woman Deputy Speaker of Ukraine. Thank you very much for joining us tonight. The theme of the program this week is Ukrainian parliamentarianism, and we went out over the week and asked a few students to share with us their thoughts about the Ukrainian parliament, whether it is a strong or a weak institution. And before we begin, I'd like to share some of their thoughts that we recorded.
We now Ukrainians, we are so disappointed of many things that happened. We are mostly focused on what we can do, each of us, like a person, like a part of some company, or if you're producing something like this, what exactly you can do, how you can change the place you live, the work you live, your behavior. I know we all try to be more open. As for me, my position, I do not expect a lot from Rada, really. I do not just trust them that much anymore. There's one thing that I'm hoping that mainly Ukrainian government, president, and all together could do, that we could do more inside of integration into Euro Union. That's my biggest dream, yeah. I want to be there together with them. Now I see that in Lviv we can work all together, business, city, and people. For example, last month we built a first dog park in Lviv.
Cool.
Yeah, with that all that cool equipment, with the stuff to clean all that. So I see that it works. And I think that's how it can change, when the triangle, business, city, and society, locally. So I mostly trust in local development than in that something will come from Rada.
The level of trust to the Rada is very low, although in some Western democracies, they'd really appreciate that kind of rating. What are some of the things that you can do as Deputy Speaker to strengthen the role of Rada in Ukraine today?
I think what is very important for any MP, doesn't matter whether there's a vice speaker or just a regular member of parliament, is to talk to people and try to explain to them at least for those MPs that who are acting in a good faith, who are independent, who are representing this post-Maidan mood, to explain people that, first of all, they cannot expect that people that they were electing for 20 years and they were doing some wrongs, then eventually they will change and they will start doing good. So if people were disappointed with the parliament for so many years, and that it was the case, people were always disappointed with the parliament, but they were still re-electing the same people. So this is, you cannot expect different result doing the same things. This is the first reason. The second reason is try to, this is for the task for both the MPs and for the people, to be accountable, yes, for what is going on. MPs, if they believe that they will be re-elected, doesn't matter what they do, they will never be accountable. And the third reason is, of course, that Ukrainian government is not accountable in front of Ukrainian parliament. And people, they kind of transfers this, disappointment with the government to the disappointment of the parliament, which is naturally, because they can see that parliament can do nothing to hold the government accountable. And the reason for this is that we have bad separation of power, that big part of executive power today in Ukraine are in the possession of the president, and the whole accountability lies with the government. And parliament cannot control the president at all. And that's why we cannot be accountable in front of our people for the deeds of the government.
That's an interesting observation. Boris, perhaps you can comment on that, because our Canadian, formerly our Canadian system, is a little bit different than the Ukrainian system. And how is accountability... how does it work in Canada as a member of parliament? This is your fourth term, I think.
It is.
And how does that manifest itself in Canadian society, in Canadian politics?
Well, before I touch on that, first of all, I'd like to express my thanks for being invited to the studio.
Mrs. Reed raised a number of issues, accountability amongst them. And we have very different systems. Canada has a heritage of the British parliamentary system where there is no clear line separating the executive and legislative branches of government. Of course, the judiciary is clearly separated and independent, and we clearly have a rule of law state in Canada, and that's one of the great lacks in Ukraine. But we also have other interesting things that we can take a look at. We have the bad example, for instance, with our neighbors to the south, the U.S., where I often refer to it as a dollarocracy as opposed to a democracy. And it's also an issue here. It's an issue in various ways. How do people get elected in their ridings, and how do people get onto lists of parties? And it's an evolutionary process that's taking place in Ukraine. The democratic processes are evolving, but it's also an opportunity to take a look at the mistakes of other democracies and to see how this very fragile emerging democracy of Ukraine can be made better. And one of the things that I note is the strong presence and continued presence of oligarchs and their resources. And it manifests itself not just in the government, but in parliament. And it'll be very important to take a look at the example. Canada did something quite interesting not that long ago, just over a decade ago, where we said no corporations, no unions, no NGOs can give donations or contribute to electoral campaigns. Only individuals can, and they're limited to $1,500. In my riding, the average cost of 125,000 people, the average cost is about $95,000 to run an election campaign. And they even account for signs that you reuse from previous campaigns. So that's added back into the cost. So you are compelled to go out, knock on doors, meet with people one-on-one. I probably knocked some $40,000 doors during the election campaign. And everyone has to do, including the prime minister, runs in a riding. So we have a very different system, but we also limit the influence of money. And I think that's something that perhaps could be looked at in regards to Ukraine, because that oligarchic control that has been maintained, at some point, that needs to be broken.
Oksana, you were elected on the Samopomich ticket. During the campaign, how many doors did you knock on?
We were trying to do this door-to-door visits, yes, to talking to people. But of course, it was almost impossible and still almost impossible to raise money from people. Why? Because this is like a dirt circle. People believe that all politicians are crook and they have enough money. So people should not donate to those crooks who are abusing such a big amounts of money. The businesses, they say, you know, those white businesses, we believe that politics is something dirty. We don't want to affiliate ourselves with the politics. But at the same time, both businesses and people, they request us to be poor and independent. So it's time and efforts to work all together. So on the one side, I have to show with all my activity to people who elected me that I am a decent person, that I am working in a good faith. I'm trying to do all the best I know using my knowledge, my experience. And maybe with the time, those people will say, okay, so this person or in this political party, they are decent. We can allocate money not to be ashamed with the affiliation of this political force. So it's long process just because of the it was discredited so severely. And oligarchs, that's true that in principle for the last 15 years, the politics was completely owned by the oligarchs. This parliament is probably the first one that has this small share of independent people that can afford themselves to express their views and vote independently. The oligarchs built the system when they established political project, they called parties, got to the parliament, created the government, got access to the three main things: natural resources, state budget, and state enterprises. Exhausted this to create new political projects to get to the parliament to create it, and it was like this. So we have to cut the circle, and we have to talk to people and to like not even to teach them, but to mature with them all together, working with them.
Well, I think it's a condition of government in general. Governments have huge resources at their disposal, tremendous power. Power attracts, those resources attract, and the issue of corruption is an issue that you'll find in every political system. To what measure is it controlled, and does it take control of the system? And when you come from a civil society background, you have particular motivators. It's different if you come to it as an oligarch. Take into account, even though people tend to have a low opinion of politicians, almost everywhere in the world, they respect political leaders, but they have a low opinion of them. And it's one thing when you extend a helping hand to someone individually, a neighbor in need. It feels pretty good. Then you can graduate to working with an organization, creating organizations where sometimes you can have a positive impact on the lives of scores, hundreds, maybe even thousands of people. Government is this huge apparatus that if you have the skill set and you learn how to manipulate this big apparatus of government, you can have a positive impact on millions. But there's that factor that all those resources of government also attract extremely capable people for the wrong reasons. They don't fully comprehend the danger of that because these people who are perhaps motivated for the wrong reasons should not be underestimated. And their rules of the game will be very different from those often that come out of civil society, because we wouldn't allow ourselves to abuse the system in those ways. And it's rough and it's hard. They often call politics a blood sport. Politics can also be an art form. And the art of politics is leadership, and people will respond, an ability to communicate a vision. And that is something that is so required today in Ukraine, because Ukraine is not in the situation of Canada, doesn't have the luxury of most of the democracies, and Ukraine is a state under an existentialist threat, facing a war, economic crisis, various internal issues, and that's why there's such a great need for political leadership that people can trust.
The system in Ukraine is susceptible to manipulation by various political interests that ebb and flow, but often enough they have at least one particular interest in mind, which is to keep the government in some form functioning. That level of manipulation, I think it's almost endemic to the system. And Boris, you mentioned about the existential threat, which is on everyone's mind. In our interviews over the weekend, indeed, everyone mentioned that it seems almost that the parliament knows about a war, but no one wants to call it that. And what can be done, Boris, to bring more attention to the fact that what we see happening on the ground isn't necessarily what the media or even what some politicians in various governments around the world are calling it? We're not calling things by their name.
Because they don't know what to expect of Putin. They they don't know how to deal with this type of individual. They don't know what to make of this hybrid form of warfare, the violence. There's a certain conditioning as well in the West. We've lived in what some call the Great Peace, this post-World War II period. And as imperfect as it was based on international treaties, agreements, and we almost had an international rule of law system put into place. And that is all at risk currently. And no one wants to take the bull by the horns, take full responsibility. President Obama shifted it over to Merkel and Hollande. They're worried about their own particular situations and dynamics. And it's not that clear type of war that one would expect. And Putin's very capable in the way he conducts this war and this massive propaganda and the corrupting of Western elites, both corporate through various business structures in Russia, but also political elites through financing of fringe parties.
Western governments aren't prepared to recognize that Russia has actually occupied Ukrainian territory. They even refuse to use the word occupation. They don't say Crimea is occupied. We have this term. It has been illegally annexed. And this is where I want to pass it over to Oksana. One of the only plans that I've come across is a plan called deoccupation. And as I understand it, you are the author of this plan, is to recognize territories as under occupation. Can you tell us a little bit about this plan?
Well, then those 2 years in war, I learned a couple of things. First of all, in principle, everybody has its own interest. In politics, and especially in geopolitics, you cannot expect to have friends. You can expect to have partners and patrons. And there is only one country that is interested to patronize Ukraine, and this is Russia. All the rest, they, to some extent, they are ready to be partners, but to the extent that Ukraine will be ready to protect itself as well. So I take it as my duty to face the reality and actually to call it the way it is, and then to demand from others to do it in the same way.
What will it take for the Ukrainian parliament to recognize the occupation?
It will be almost impossible because Minsk doesn't allow this. So Minsk, in principle, Minsk denies the recognition of the occupation that is now in Ukraine.
But again, we spoke about this earlier, Boris. Minsk was never ratified. It wasn't a document that required parliamentary ratification. And this is something that I think are we Ukrainians artificially tying our hands?
Yep. Well, I want to make it clear, because from the distance I understand that it's not that visible. Minsk happened because actually Western powers, they were expecting somehow in a very quick manner to resolve this issue. They were expecting that the dragon came just to eat one person, one girl, yeah? But eventually the dragon came to eat the whole village, you know? And if you sacrifice Ukraine, it doesn't mean that you resolve the problem. The problem will be just raising, because you will be just provoking the dragon to do it on and on. So Minsk, I would say this is, of course, this is incapability of Ukraine in this defense area. We are weak. We were weak at that moment. We are weak.
Militarily.
We could not, of course, and nobody can confront now the military force of Russia, maybe except of the United States. This is the reality in principle. But it was also the point of weakness for the whole Western community, because they they didn't want to take accountability for the fact that one of the permanent members of the Security Council, the, well, partly European country, actually destroyed the whole security and legal order in the world. And they just didn't want to deal with this because it would be too bothering. And the simplest way was to try to resolve the conflict in Ukraine than to resolve the conflict in Russia. Those are two different conflicts. If they would call it a conflict with Russia, it would be the world conflict. And it would be more easy to resolve the local, small local conflict.
Let me share a final quote on this topic.
Yeah, well, I guess it's quite surreal because officially we're not at war with anyone. There's no aggressors. No one's attacking us. And I think the thing is that obviously our deputies, they have a complete understanding of what's going on. And I think they do somewhere in the backs of their brains, they do realize that they have responsibilities. But they're getting away with not doing any of it. And they have their own interests at heart. They have interests in Russia. They have business partners there. They would probably not do anything which would hinder their own business interests. So right now, there's no consolidation. There's no unification in the parliament. There's no common strategy. No official statements have been made. So it's just certain people, certain deputies voicing these issues, but not as the parliament as a whole. So I think it's a surreal situation, absolutely, which is really weird.
This was a student at your alma mater, Keva Mohyla Academy.
But this is genuine voice. This is absolutely what normal people speak about, because they don't know those fluffy words, you know, that politicians or diplomats are using. And they are just telling the reality. And it was the expression of reality. Because, for example, if you want to know what is going on, what was this conflict, anti-terroristic operation or whatever, you go to the east. You go to the front line. You would never face such a word. You would never listen to such a word. You would never hear this word. They say war. And they don't say that this is a war with separatists. They always say this is... they've always mentioned Russia. Russians, they go there, they go here. So this is the reality. You cannot invent anything there. They have no time. They are under permanent attack. They are living with their, like, I would say, basic instincts, because they are surviving. And I mean, soldiers and people living on the front line. That's why you would always hear the truth. As well, if you want to understand what is the perception from about other issues, you go to just normal people and ask them, and they will tell you what it is. And this plan that I've been describing, it is not my invention. I talked to dozens of people, just normal people, including those from internally displaced, those who were actually moved from their territories on the east, and just normal people. And they were explaining me this. So this is the common sense. And I think that if you want, as you mentioned, Mr. Jasnevsky, that if they only the just peace can last. So, and just this is what is percepted by normal people. And I believe that if you do it honestly, if you do it with the feeling of reality, understanding of reality, only then we can achieve the stable result. And the victory, if you speak, the victory is the point of no return of a war. And here I would say that this is not only for Ukraine, but also for the worst. They can only say that they got the victory, that the conflict is resolved, when it cannot return. Now, it's not only for Ukraine, but for the West, we are too far from the victory yet.
Next week, the IMF will be reviewing the new aid tranche to Ukraine. The success of the e-filing program is one of the items that the IMF will be watching for in deciding whether to extend more loans to Ukraine. Ukraine Calling will be watching this and other stories. If you have any questions or comments, please write to the show at ukrainecalling@hromadskeradio.org. I'm Marco Supran in Kyiv.
Thanks for listening.